On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
Welcome to an automotive conversation hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria Digital Radio and the World Wide Web today. Recently, two beautiful books crossed my desk pretty much at the same time, and we thought, well, what could be better? Bruce Newton has collaborated with Toby Hagen to put together a book about the 50 cars that drove Australia. It's called Kings of the Road, and it's a celebration of local cars or those that have made an impact. It includes some foreign cars and surprising things like the Bushmaster military vehicle and combis and Toyota Land Cruisers and the like, but of course also the iconic Monaros and Taranas and Brabhams and FJ Holdens, Ford GTHOs and so on. Bruce will join me shortly. Also, retired designer in the automotive industry, Paul Berenger, has written a beautiful book about design, a history of automotive design in Australia since the war. He's interviewed a lot of the people he has himself worked with, but he also goes through and explains to us, for the novice, exactly how complex the design of cars actually is. So they're both going to come in and talk about their beautiful books on The Conversation Hour today. My co-host is Harriet Edquist. She's the Foundation President of the Automotive Historians Australia Group and Professor of Architectural History and Director of the Design Archives at RMIT University. Harriet, good morning to you.
Good morning, John.
You're not the typical petrol head.
No, I'm not a typical petrol head. As everyone laughs when I tell them, I don't drive and I know very little about car mechanicals or anything that I've been teaching myself about automotive history in this country.
Why?
Well, the origins of this interest, in fact, lie in the archives, because we do hold, since some collections of automotive designers, for example, Philip Smoot, and when that collection came in 2010, it suddenly dawned on me that we had a local design capacity here. I just assumed, possibly like a lot of other people do, that cars came in from somewhere else and Australians didn't have a lot to do with the way they looked.
So someone in Detroit or wherever would say, follow these plans.
Follow these plans. And I was wrong. And so it was really looking at that archive, and the drawings are absolutely beautiful. I mean, every time we bring them out to show to people, even whether you know anything about cars, they're stunning drawings. I mean, Philip could really get his hand around a texter or a pencil or whatever it was
he used. What era are we talking about then?
Well, he became the first Australian chief of the design studio at GMH in 68, I think it was. So he joined GM straight after he'd studied at RMIT in the, I think, about 1960. And he continued through into the 80s. So he was very, very influential in the whole sort of development of Australian design capacity at GMH, which continues to this day.
So you can be fascinated with the aesthetics of it, but you've turned it into an academic study, into a discipline in its own right.
Yes, yes.
So why? Why have you become so immersed in something that's so alien to you?
It's a bit pig-headedness of me, I suppose. But when I was commissioned by the National Gallery of Victoria to put on an exhibition in 2015 called Shifting Gear, which was an overview of local design, Australian design, automotive design, from the first Thompson steam car in the late 1890s up until now, well, up until 2015. Being a novice, I had to do an enormous amount of research. So I read everything I could read online. I read all the books I could read. I interviewed people. And I'm an academic historian, and what occurred to me was that a lot of what I was reading wasn't referenced. There was no sources that were given, and a lot of it was contradictory, and I found it very difficult to go back and find the primary source. And so once we did Shifting Gear, I worked with a lot of people who were incredibly generous with their knowledge and helped me a lot. We decided to academicise, if you like, this whole area so that we could start putting a framework, a sort of research academic framework around it that would allow future researchers to build on our research, which is the way it works in, you know, any sort of research field. So it was to sort of give it some frameworks, some academic frameworks, which is what we still do.
It's kind of like, I mean, as we've shut down the car industry, we haven't shut down the design aspects. Indeed, in some ways, there's even more design being done in new technology, both for Ford and Holden in this city, and hundreds of people working on all sorts of lines and ranges, but also components. The component industry is continuing, even though we're not assembling and exporting cars. So it's still relevant, and it's very much part of the industrial history of Melbourne. Part of its post-Gold Rush success was because of the sustaining influence of automotive assembly and manufacturing in Australia. So it's our story.
Absolutely, and I'm glad you brought in components, because that was something we were really good at. And from the get-go, we were designing engines and parts of engines and bits of chassis and things like that, and putting out patents. And Norm Darwin has written a book recently on early automotive design in Australia, and he's gone through the patent office and he's found all these Australian patents for componentry. So that is it's a very neglected part of the automotive story, but it's actually a really important one. And we're very good at that. We're good at the technical sort of know-how and how to get cars that actually fit Australian circumstances. And yes, I think it is very much part of our intellectual, if you like, capacity, and part of our design capacity and part of our manufacturing capacity.
I just remember 20 years ago being absolutely astonished to learn that fuel gauges, or the sender units for fuel gauges, were manufactured and assembled in a factory in outer suburban and rural Melbourne for the world. And there were container loads of these pieces. They were being put together in a factory here, and they were going off to factories all over the world, in South Africa, in Asia, in Europe, and so on it went. And that's but one example out of all sorts of different components. The Bosch factory out in Dandenong was making parts and exporting them off to the world, that, you know, whether it was electrical components for charging systems or switches or whatever it might be. All sorts of stuff going on here, and nobody knew.
I know. And
we never measured it. We never celebrated it.
It's extraordinary. And one of my particular sort of favourites is Repco, funnily enough. I mean, you might say this is very strange, but I've written a bit about Repco, and they were amazing in this whole area of componentry. And the fact that they started, yes, they refitted overseas and they redesigned stuff that came in, but they also designed their own. And they designed so well that a number of their products won good design awards. So they're very important. I suppose the other area, one reason why I'm interested in this, is because I am an architectural historian, but I'm also a design historian, and design history in Australia is not that well researched, and automotive is part of our design history, so I want to get it in there. And this is very much part of it, is these designed bits of cars.
And if you want to talk about the future and technology and the clever country, and you want to talk about driverless cars, you want to talk about sustainable energy, all of that is part and parcel of the same discipline. And
it
if you've
is,
got
and we
engineers,
can do it. Yeah.
If you've got engineers and you've got people who are clever at solving problems, well, this is where they cut their teeth.
Absolutely. Yeah, I completely agree. And I think there's a big future in what we can do, because we've always done it. There's no reason why we can't continue to do it, just simply because the technology's changed.
So do you teach some of the students who are doing industrial design and engineering?
No, I don't.
That's a pity, because I've been into those laboratories at RMIT and some of the workshops where they're teaching things like 3D printing computer-generated designs and images. So, you know, you don't make a mould or a pattern and go and cut it on a lathe anymore. Instead, you design it on a screen using the software and computer design that is three-dimensional, and then you hit a button and it prints it out in whatever medium you want, whether it's plastic or titanium or, you know, whatever it might be, and comes off a printer.
This is true.
And the students are being snapped up by the time they're in second year. Industry is already commissioning them and saying, we'll pay your fees as long as you're bonded to come and work for us when you graduate, because we can't find people who know what you know.
Yeah, those, I think, it's not just RMIT, but I think a lot of those industrial design studios now are quite amazing, and the skill sets that the students come out with are extraordinary.
I was shown around by your boss.
Really?
Yes, Martin Bean.
Oh, really?
Who's in charge of RMIT University now. He's the Vice-Chancellor.
Yep.
He was like a kid in a lolly shop.
Yes.
I think he pretty much wanted to just go and play with these machines himself rather than run the university.
Yep, I can definitely understand that.
Remarkable. His face lit up like a neon sign as he went, oh,
it is
show me how that works.
Extraordinary, yeah.
It's breathtaking. And some of what you're teaching there is the sort of stuff that for some of the private companies, some of the big industrial conglomerates, that's pretty much kept behind wraps. That's some of their most secret laboratory work that normally the public never get to see. But, you know, you're teaching kids how to do it before they go off to those jobs.
Yeah, well, you have to. And I think the thing now, everyone talks about being agile and nimble, and that's one of the things that you have to be. You simply got to keep on top of the technology, which changes all the time. And so those labs are constantly refreshed and renewed. And, yes, the students simply have to know that. Otherwise, they're unemployable.
Yeah, so the design studios at General Motors in Fisherman's Bend, the design studios at Ford in Broadmeadows are continuing. They're still working, hundreds and hundreds of people working on top secret designs, whether they're designing a door handle or they're designing a bracket or they're designing a whole dashboard. In fact, I'm not allowed if I'm, I probably, well, it's so long ago now, but a couple of years ago I was shown around and they had five modules mocked up full scale dashboards and seating arrangements so that you could sit in and say, well, we're trialling this one with the switch gear and we're getting a whole lot of people to come through and just see how tactile and user-friendly and how intuitive it all is. And then, okay, spend 5 minutes in that one. Now unbuckle and get out and get into this practice dashboard and seat arrangement, which is parked next to it. And these are, you know, there's nothing else there. There's just the dashboard, the gear lever, the tunnel, the transmission tunnel, and all the instruments, steering wheel, binnacle, seat. So you're sitting there and they're just saying, now try this one and tell us how you find it. And they've built them all, and then they're comparing them before they decide which one they'll run with.
Yeah,
it's fantastic stuff. It's really exciting.
It's terrific, and I think the more people who know about it and just know the the capacity that we have in that area, the better, because it's something to be very proud of. And I think one of the sort of issues about manufacturing going out of the country is that there's a sort of a bit of despair, I think, around about, you know, where we're going. But as you say, the design studios still remain, and design is infinitely transferable.
So the 1899 Thompson steam car that was built in High Street, Armidale,
yes,
as early as anyone anywhere almost in the world was building a self-propelling coach on four wheels. I mean, that should be on a rotating plinth with a spotlight on it in the foyer of the museum.
Indeed, it should be. I agree. Yeah, it's extraordinary. And he, I mean, he is generally credited with being Australia's first sort of manufacturer, because he produced a few Thompsons. It wasn't just the one-off. He did produce a very short run of vehicles. So he is generally considered to be the first Australian manufacturer of an Australian automobile.
And, you know, whether they even knew what was being done in other parts of the world. I mean,
I think
they
would have.
They might have heard
something. I mean, Australians have always been global. They had to be. So people...
But they couldn't log on in 1899 to see what was happening in Germany.
No, but they would import things. They would import... They knew what Benz were doing. They imported Benz engines and so forth. And people went overseas. They travelled, even though it took rather a long time. But still, no, they... And they got, you know, journals and people visited. So they were, you know... They knew what was happening.
It is still an extraordinary achievement. Anyway, let's celebrate with Paul Berenger. He joins Harriet Edquist from the Automotive Historians Association, also RMIT University, where she teaches design. Paul Berenger is a retired automotive designer, and he's self-published a book called Crayon to CAD. CAD stands for computer-assisted design. It's a history of post-war automotive design in Australia. It's a beautiful, large book. And Paul, congratulations to you.
Good morning, John and Harriet, and thank you very much for that.
And along the way, you tell us the story of the evolution of Australian automotive design and history, and what a remarkable history it is. And it's one that hardly anybody knows. Why is that?
Well, firstly, I think it's because design is a hidden part of the car company's development process. It's a business that's behind secure walls, and it's something that's very rarely shown to the public. So the awareness of actually how a car is designed, the actual body design, the engineering of the vehicle, is very much part of the intellectual property of a car company that they preserve, because that's their competitive advantage. But the main reason for writing the book, in fact, was that I started my career at Holden in 1968. And when I started there, my first boss was a guy called Alf Pays. Alf Pays was a South Australian who came across from Woodville to Melbourne post-war to work on the first Holden. We're now in 2018, and as you've correctly said, the motor manufacturing side has disappeared. But I'm pleased to say that design is still alive and well in Australia. General Motors, Ford and Toyota all have vibrant design studios here in Melbourne.
Have Toyota kept theirs?
I'm absolutely.
Not, they have,
yes.
Okay, good.
And they're
sure.
moving to a much bigger centre out at the old Altona manufacturing site next year. So all those three companies are aggressively promoting their skills on a global stage. And many of the people who have worked in those design studios are now in design studios around the world. And that's a really positive sign that Australians really not only can cope with design projects, but they can lead them.
Okay, so one of the things that we don't really value, though, is the stuff that we don't know about and see. So you're quite right that companies are, you know, they're, sometimes it's a bit hush-hush. But even still, the history of it, so you don't want to, they want to tell us what they're working on for next year or the year after or even 10 years from now, but surely they should be able to tell us the story behind what they've already released.
John, I think we have an appalling attitude towards our history in Australia generally, and the automotive industry is no better. Archives have been distributed overseas. It's hard to actually consolidate the archives of the car companies in Australia, and when I was researching the book, it really came down to a lot of individual people around the country who had squirreled away their own personal stories, and once they knew, as an automotive designer, I had some empathy with their life and what they'd achieved, they were very open with me in pulling out from under their bed or from above their wardrobe their treasured stories. And I've, where possible, within the space of crayon to CAD, I've tried to include those in the book just as a small story, because of course, as you realise, not only was it Holden, Ford and Chrysler that really led the post-war history in Australia, but it was the Nissans and the Toyotas and the Renaults, of course, were built out in Heidelberg.
So Renault, Peugeot and even Citroën at one stage.
Absolutely right. Yeah, and, yeah. And BMC, of course, in Zetland in Sydney. So
Gogomobiles.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the book, in fact, there's a great story, I think, on Bill Buckle, who was a real post-war pioneer, the Gogomobile. And
the Lightburn Zeta.
Well, it's another South Australian success story that
I'm
you
not
might.
Sure about a success.
I think it is for those who still own them, but but
it is an icon in South Australia. They love it.
Yeah,
yeah. But the history of Australian automotive industry, of course, has been dictated particularly by General Motors, who did most of the heavy lifting post-war in automotive design, and many of the people who started their careers at GMH moved into other companies, and they were able to extol the skills and success of the design trade generally in what they were doing. And the breadth of design talent in Australia was and still is there, and we must, as Harriet was talking about earlier, we must ensure that we don't lose the capability of training these people and giving them career opportunities as they move out. I think we have to look at the dynamics of the automotive industry now and look more towards the dynamics of mobility. Treat mobility as in the bigger picture of what we can train people to do and the opportunities that we'll give them in the future.
It's a complex issue trying to predict the future. Is of course it's a pretty guaranteed path to madness and probably some sort of bankruptcy as well. You can pretty much get it wrong more often than you're going to get it right. But that's effectively what automotive design has to do. You have to try and pick consumer trends, fashions, as well as technology. Hmm. Well, that's a pretty big ask, and yet that's it.
You get a lot of support to do that, and of course we've moved from a society of coach building, which was almost bespoke coach building for individuals back in the early part of the 20th century, into the 1930s and 40s, where large corporations began to absorb the smaller companies, and as they did that, the design became more dedicated to the corporate style. Now, this was before, of course, we went global. And as we've gone global and the internet has really allowed every individual to see what's happening around the world, design has been globalized. Design rules have become globalized. Technology has become globalized. And in many cases, the supplier companies offer the car companies new technologies, and the car companies then adopt those technologies. So it's not just the car companies driving design. As much as anything else, it's these small, medium-sized businesses that, in fact, are inspiring the car companies to try new ideas.
Lots of text messages. Don't forget the Hartnett car and the Chamberlain tractors. There's a few other contributions coming through by text message.
Absolutely.
So anyway, Harriet, we can't forget those.
No.
To what extent, though, and Paul, this might be a delicate question, but it needs to be clarified, to what extent were Australian designers actually being creative, and to what extent were you just doing odd jobs for people in Detroit or back in the UK or wherever it might have been where the commission came from?
You always have to reflect on the company ownership to start with, and whether that's from Detroit or Nagoya or Rüsselsheim. What you have to think of is the local taste, local market taste, and Australians were very successful in nurturing the design industry to focus on local customer tastes. As we went more global, of course, we were in a situation where we were looking at export business for Australia. And in the design of that, it wasn't only the actual exterior styling or the interior design. It was really the engineering of the vehicle overall. Because, as you know, Australia's had a love affair with front-engine rear-wheel drive cars for many, many years. And, in fact, that was our unique selling proposition back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And that gave Australia a pretty strong export opportunity with those cars. Technology's changed, people downsized with the fuel crisis, other influences dictated that, particularly package size, that people wanted more space. So the architecture of the car was changing, the driveline was changing, we moved towards ultimately front-wheel drive, which was a no-no in the large car market back in the 60s and 70s. It's now become the norm, and it's become the norm because technology has improved and we're able to make cars like that. Specifically, though, as we became more global, designers had to look out and understand who the customers were around the world, and we had to design for those customers. And as we did that, the design arguably has become more generic. It's become more acceptable to buy a car that you design in Melbourne has to be sold in Asia, it has to be sold in Europe, has to be sold in the United States. And the whole point is now, We must forget these silos. We're in one big silo, and that's called the world. And the world wants design that suits those particular market segments.
Can I commit a few acts of very quick heresy before Bruce Newton joins us? First of all, I think most cars being designed these days are really dull, visually dull. Agree or disagree?
They're designed for a customer who wants a particular type of car. They're dictated to by design rules. They're dictated by customer demand for certain style, certain information, certain specifications.
Lowest common denominator. They lack character, personality, or any particular appeal.
I think that each brand is looking for its own brand identity, John. I think Mercedes, BMW, General Motors are all striving for that knockout design that creates a powerful image for that particular brand and really attracts people into it. But in some ways then you're reducing the number of basic designs that car manufacturers are able to produce.
If you were blindfolded and put in most of the affordable cars, I'm not talking about supercars, but just your average cars these days, you wouldn't even know which one you're in.
And I think that's more and more happening, and that's really where a lot of companies are losing that brand loyalty now. People cross-shop more because there's not enough uniqueness in the cars. But in many ways, there's two different types of customers in the car business. There are the people who want to be seen driving something different. And by the way, if I see one pass me on the road, I'll wave. And that's individuality reflected more and more in brands that are looking at the mass market. The other side of the equation is a customer who is much more comfortable being part of the pack. So if he or she is driving down the road and is surrounded by cars with the same badge on it, they can justify the purchase based on a lot of people have made that decision, so I've made a good decision.
Now, we'll talk about individual cars with Bruce when he joins us in just a moment. But just finally, Paul, how do you learn to think three-dimensionally? Because what designers do is you take an idea or a drawing and you turn it into an actual object. So you have to be able to think three-dimensionally.
I'd go back a step and saying the first time you put pen to paper, you're thinking three-dimensionally.
How do you learn to do that?
I guess it's an inherent skill. I'm not too sure. Harriet may have a different view on this, being from the university side of things, but I believe that you have an inherent understanding of how you can visualise something. I think whenever you're designing, you're always in your head walking around the product. You're always thinking about what happens when the doors open and you actually move into that product. So I think there's an inherent skill there that in many ways, John, I have to say, as an old guy, is being lost in the current generations, who are more comfortable using a computer and allowing the computer to create the three-dimensional images, many of which, when they're sketched in two dimensions, don't transfer to three dimensions. They don't work. And that's really where, in many ways, art has to go back to the fundamentals. It has to really get people to understand what something looks like, not only just looking at it in one view, but actually being able to rotate it and see what the thing looks like in three dimensions.
Says Paul, holding up a paper cup or a plastic cup as an example. Do you agree, Harriet?
Well, I've never been terribly keen on the notion of inherent anything. I think, yes, people are born with certain, you know, capacities. That's absolutely undoubted. But you learn those skills. You learn to be a designer. You don't come out of, you know, into the world as a designer. And I'm always intrigued when I read these autobiographies of designers who say they went to a particular institution and they didn't learn anything, and yet somehow 3 years later they come out and they're snapped up by industry. So I think, you know, you learn to be a designer like you learn to be anything else. It's a skill you learn, and you learn to think three-dimensionally. Some people are better at it than others, but these are all things that one learns either in a college or in a design studio at Holden.
Which is pretty much why you teach people
exactly
this.
This is right.
Paul, if people want to buy a copy of your book, are they available to the public to buy, because you've self-published?
Yes, John. Crayon to CAD's available through c2cpublishing.com.au, which is my own site, and as of about 2 or 3 weeks ago, in all good bookshops.
Oh, okay. Well, congratulations. I presume it's expensive because it's, what is it, a couple of hundred pages?
336, I think, John.
It weighs a ton. It's
2.5 kilos.
lavishly published on top grade paper with enormous numbers of black and white and colour photographs throughout. So I presume it's not a cheap production.
No, it's $95.
$95. Well, just so people are aware, I might say I have not enjoyed a car book as much for a very long time. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
It's something that you never ever, and I you know, I consume car books like, you know, it's scandalous, but I've never seen one that goes where this book goes, because it's usually dismissed in a few pages in the history of a car company or the production run. This is a whole book devoted just to the design. It's absolutely fascinating. A History of Post-War Automotive Design. It's called Crayon to CAD. The author is Paul Berenger, and you can get it from his website, c2cpublishing.com.au. That's with the number two, c2cpublishing.com.au, and in some good bookshops. Paul, congratulations. We're all joined in the studio by co-author, together with Toby Hagen, of a beautiful book called Kings of the Road, 50 Cars That Drove Australia. Morning to you, Bruce. Congratulations.
Morning, John. Thanks for the invite.
There's Combis, there's Toyota Land Cruisers, there's obviously FX and FJ Holdens and Commodores and all the rest of it, GTHO Falcons, but
it's an eclectic mix, isn't it?
It certainly is. Have you ever driven some of the rubbish cars that we used to sell here in the 50s and 60s?
I certainly travelled in them with my parents, and that's probably where I started my love affair with cars, sitting in the back seats of Falcons and Kingswoods and Belmonts and even Monaros.
Ever driven an FJ Holden?
I haven't, to be honest.
Paul?
My first car was a 48215 Holden, so
the predecessor, yeah.
I certainly have. That's where I started my motoring interest.
Can you remember what it was like? Or how would
yes, I can remember what it was like under the bonnet more than I can in the seat because I spent most of the time repairing it.
Terrible cars.
Yeah.
Handled like a bucket of bolts, couldn't stop, couldn't go around corners, noisy, unreliable, and people loved them.
John, if you read the early motoring reports and feedback from customers, you're absolutely right. They loved it because they had a diet previously of rotten old English cars that fell apart and weren't very economical. And so, yes, the Holden was a revelation.
So what we're proving here as much as anything, Bruce, is that sometimes there's almost no relationship between nostalgia and affection on the one hand and actual engineering excellence on the other.
It's absolutely true, and that's part of the point of the book. The 50 that we have aren't driven by sales performance or engineering excellence. There's a whole bunch of different reasons they're in there. It could even be because they were famous through a TV ad or because they were on a movie or something like that. There's a whole bunch of different parameters we used.
And the values of some of these cars today, I don't know if that catches your attention quite as much as...
There's a massive market for Australian muscle cars. The GDHO Phase 3 sold the other day for over $1 million.
Yeah. And Monaros now, especially early ones, fetching a fortune. Toronto XU1s, if you've got one in the shed, leave it there. It's better than your superannuation. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's a bit of a gamble, historic car futures, but if you pick the right car, yeah, it can certainly pay off.
What's your weakness?
In terms of cars... Local cars. I've got I started covering the industry in the late 80s and through a really golden era, which Paul was heavily involved with, where we had the best local vehicles developed. Funnily enough, it's true, isn't it, Paul? The late days of the industry, we had vehicles like the Territory, the VH Commodore, the Australian influence on the Toyotas when you were involved there. It was they were terrific vehicles, and the people that did them, John, were passionate, committed. They worked on a shoestring. I mean, people say, well, the Commodore took $1 billion to develop, but if that car had been developed in North America, it would have cost $5 billion. Mm. So, yeah, it's incredibly sad that the industry's gone because so many great people were involved with it, and they really did build some terrific cars.
What is it that triggers an emotional connection to a car? This must be an area of academic study. Harriet, why is it that, you know, you go to Bathurst or any of these things, the people are Ford families or Holden families. People are tribal. They love cars. There are people who devote their lives to obscure things, whether it's a Sunbeam or a Bristol or a Daimler or whatever it might be, or a Mustang. People go completely besotted.
I actually don't know, and I'm not sure that, certainly in automotive history, I'm not sure that anyone has done that research. It's certainly really fascinating. It should be done.
But I think
it's
Bruce
a bit like
nailed
a footy team.
Yeah, that's right. I think Bruce nailed it in many ways. I think it's an association. It's a movie you saw, a book you read, what your folks drove when they were, you know, when you were young, and you connect with that. You become rusted onto that, and I think in many ways now, with the affluence of the older generation, they're reliving their childhood and they're going back to days. I feel embarrassed now because I see a Tirana on the road and it's got historic plates on it. It was my company car. And I think about that now and I think, well, why not? You know, they weren't particularly great cars, but people have that association. They have a belief that those cars were important to them. They aspired to them as young people. They couldn't afford the $3,000 to buy it in those days. Now they can. They can afford the $80,000 to buy a Tirana.
So, Bruce, what do you think creates this tribal connection?
In Australia, I think if you go back in history, you can see that Ford and Holden did dominate the landscape, and that people were split between the two. That's eroding now because the market is so diverse, and I don't think... And there's a generation now of people who don't really have the car as integral to their life. When you think about it, in days past, Australia, massive country, sparse population, the car was really the freedom machine for a lot of people. It got them to places that they would never get any other way. They met people they would never meet any other way. And for them, I guess, that became part of their life, an extension of their character.
I think, Harry, it's onto something. It's like footy teams. I was at the Phillip Island Historic Races, and Alan Moffat had just put out a memoir, and he was signing caps or copies of the book if you bought it and the queue to get him to sign a cap. I think it was, you had to buy the cap. I don't know whether it was 15, 20 bucks, whatever it might have been. But to get his signature, the queue was halfway around the racetrack. Well, I'm exaggerating, but there were hundreds of people just prepared to worship and have that moment with Alan Moffat. It was extraordinary.
You talk about the Ford-Holden rivalry, but Paul and I were talking about this before we came on air. There's another huge tribal group in Australia now, and that's the Toyota Group, just been in the outback. And the amount of Land Cruiser lovers and Hilux lovers and those sorts of people, the grey nomads, the vast majority of them tow with Toyotas. So the Ford and Holden thing definitely exists. The
now Toyota, it's Toyota-Nissan.
Well, less Nissan, but definitely Toyota. Nissan is one of the support players out there.
No, it's the rivalry, though, between Toyota and Nissan. I had to laugh, and I couldn't take a photo because I was driving, but the other day I saw a huge, big, dolled up, pumped up, on the steroids Nissan Patrol on a tow truck with that bumper sticker saying Toyota Rescue Vehicle, because Nissan's put the Toyota Rescue Vehicle on their cars and people in Toyotas have Nissan Rescue Vehicle on their car, and there this one was on a tow truck broken down.
Yeah, the Land Cruiser versus Patrol thing, that's a very healthy debate, there's no doubt about it.
Don't even start on Land Rovers.
Yeah. You talked about styling before with boring design. Well, if you think it's boring now, think about this. People are buying more and more SUVs. They're all five-door wagons. So that homogenous design that you're worried about, that's going to become more and more uniform as we go forward.
And yet, if you have a look, you know, things that I think that was the DS Citroen won the design object of the century, and you look at, say, an E-Type Jag or whatever it might be, and you have a look and say, well, that is like gobsmackingly beautiful in its own right. Even if you know, Harry, you don't even drive, but you can immediately go, that is just an object of great beauty.
Yep.
But I can't think of anything that comes out on the market now, and I flip through the magazines and look through the automotive pages and go,
I think my view of that, John, is that the Citroen was designed for the French, and if anybody else liked it, that was a bonus. The E-Type was an indulgent design and probably designed as much for the English as the American market. But as I mentioned earlier, really, we're in a global market now, and large corporations that will spend $1 billion on a new product are risk adverse. Their performance will be judged by their shareholders. The range of cars, the segment-busting models that are being introduced almost weekly, really just trying to find a sweet spot that a consumer will want to buy. So, unfortunately, like a lot of other products, the products are now designed for global markets, and the acceptance is that they're going to be widely purchased.
I'm getting so many text messages here. The 2005 V8 Holden Adventure, great car. That's probably someone who's trying to sell one, so they're trying to
hang on to it for about 40 years. You might get a bit of money for it.
Sold my 1973 XU1 in 2004 for $24,000. To buy one today, you wouldn't get change out of $100,000. Bloody hell, says Bob from Essendon. On and on. I love 2CVs, Citroens, more than anything else. I can't explain it, but it just makes me happy to be in it. Bought a little Nissan Pulsar, brand new in 1990. Its name is Brian. It's been my true and trusted friend for 28 years. I mean, this is what people do. Yep. They go completely nuts. I'm being asked to discuss all sorts of things like Peugeot 203s. No. What about Alphas? Yes. So on and on. That can pretty much go forever. Yeah. But people's relationship, are Australians any different, do you think, Bruce, to anyone in anywhere else in the world? I mean, Americans love their cars. Mm. They go nuts for their great big trucks, and they go nuts for Corvettes and Mustangs and so on around the world. Italians, I mean, don't even start asking Italians about their cars.
I think you're right. In places where the motor vehicle has been established for a long time, 100 years plus, definitely those passions exist, those tribal rivalries exist. Probably places where it's less emergent as yet is places like China, India, Asia, places where the car has is only now, over the last decade plus, starting to make an impact on a mass scale.
Well, the concept of personal ownership of a car in China is a very recent invention.
Mm. Mm.
You know, your parents never would have had a car, and if you've got one, you've really made it.
Mm. Well, nowadays there, it might be recent, but it's massive now. Mm. It's the biggest car market in the world by sales.
And they've got to divide up in Beijing and Shanghai whether you drive odds and evens on different days, otherwise no one moves.
Mm. John, in 1990, I presented a paper in a place called Yantai in China, and it was to a group of about 200 industrial designers. And during the meal after that presentation, I asked my host, how many of these people in this room would own a car? And the answer was probably none. And, well, how many would have licenses? Oh, maybe three or four of 200 young people in the room. And the main reason was because they all owned bicycles, because there was no infrastructure to support cars. There were no fuel stations. There was nowhere to park them. They had to drag their bikes up four or five, maybe 10 stories, because if they left them on the ground floor, the wheels would be stolen. And that just reflects Bruce's story about how much has changed in the last 20, 25 years. And it's a massive market, but whether they will ever have the passion for cars that we do is another question, because it's another consumer product that they haven't grown up with. They've just seen it recently appear on their roadways.
Texts again, and they're coming in faster than I can keep up. Is there a cure for Roveritis? Land Rovers breed at my place, says Ian. Have a look at the Maybach 6 Cabriolet made by Mercedes. Wow. If you want to talk about how there's no good new designs, have a look at this one. You're wrong. Bolwell Nagari, Leyland P76, says Mal in Blackburn. Now, we could devote an entire program to the P76, couldn't we?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
For people who don't know?
Yeah, a much maligned vehicle, and undeservedly so in most ways, I would argue, Paul. Yeah,
Made by? Mm.
BMC Leyland. It was locally designed and manufactured at the Zetland plant up in Sydney, as Paul's previously alluded to. Had a very short life, very controversial life.
Describe it.
Full-size sedan designed to take on the Falcon, Holden Kingswood, the Chrysler Valiant of the day, came with choice of six-cylinder and V8 engines. An Italian-designed wedge-shaped. And one of the proud boasts of the car was that it could fit a 44-gallon drum in the boot. Now, what the value of that was, I'm not
sure how many people ever put a 44-gallon drum in the boot. Yeah.
Subject of a vitriolic campaign from Holden, Ford and Chrysler against it, and also struggled with manufacturing issues and quality issues.
Now, but if you've got a Targa Florio P76 sitting in a shed, which is the sort of super-duper version of it, well, you're sitting on a little pot of gold, because they only made a few of those. But by and large, I mean, you never see them on the roads anymore. Mm.
No,
they're all in garages, the ones that remain, I think. And they built a wagon as well. They were just about to launch the wagon. So they had an absolutely strategic plan to take on the big three in Australia at that stage. Of course, by then, in England, the company British Leyland was in turmoil.
Why? Whatever did happen to the British manufacturing industry?
And Australia suffered because of that. So in 1974, you know, they closed their doors and that car went into history. They'd actually already done a facelift on the car. So they were well advanced in moving forward with that product.
Now the gags are coming in. What does Fiat stand for?
Fix it again, Tony.
Very good. Alpha?
No.
Always looking for another? Yeah, right. Okay. Why do Ladas have heated rear windows? Keep your hands warm while you're pushing them every morning. Yeah, thanks very much, everybody. Of course, there's all of those gags and a whole lot more. So, Bruce, the whole business of having an Australian industry has sustained generations of not just small boys, but even what should be more sensible grown-ups as well. We don't have a car manufacturing industry anymore. So what takes its place? What happens to all that pent-up emotion?
It's a good question. I think some of it just dissipates. I don't know about you, Paul, but certainly the closure of the industry is I've lost some enthusiasm and passion for the industry because I do love the Australian cars and have a strong affinity to them. But I think we're heading into an era where the car becomes a less emotionally central part of our life anyway, John. For enthusiasts such as us, for sure, we'll always have a space for them, but there are many people now, as I think I said before, you know, the car just isn't central to their lives. And as autonomy, ride sharing, those sort of trends become more and more emergent in a world where urbanisation is becoming ever more common, I think, you know, the car is going to have a less passionate place in our lives.
So, Harriet, you teach the history, but you must also think about the future. I mean, presumably a kid who's born in Australia today, they will maybe never own or drive a car. It'll be some driverless pod that picks them up and transports them to where they need to go.
Well, that's the predicted future. Whether or not it'll happen that way, I've got no idea. But certainly urbanites, you know, young urbanites, people who live in the cities, they often don't have cars. There's no need for them. And in a share house, for example, I'm thinking of one example, one person has the car and they all share it and they all chip in and pay for the petrol and so forth. Mm. And I think that's just the reality. I mean, getting around Melbourne is just a nightmare because of the cars. So,
I don't know. I quite enjoy it. Got more time to sit and admire the landscape. Have a look at what's coming towards you at a very slow pace. You get to enjoy admiring the lines on whatever it is that's making its way down the road.
John, I just throwing in a bit of a pun for design. I think that we have to look at mobility in a different way now. We are old school when it comes to the way we grew up, and I totally support Bruce's view that we're moving to a point where cars will become a commodity, often unbranded. And I'll just throw another thing at you, and that is that the traditional brands out there are really relying more and more on the connectivity and the technology that's in brands like telephones and other things now to operate. So really the car is a physical object that moves people around, but people are being moved around more by the technology they carry in their back pocket. And there's the need to actually connect with each other physically and share information and emotions. That's disappearing very, very sadly.
So it's become part of our culture, not just part of something that's useful. Look, they're still coming in. Lotus, lots of trouble, usually serious. That's a new one to me.
Never heard that one before.
Never.
But I can understand why it came up.
Okay. Just quick curveball for you, Bruce. If you sell 100 million thousand copies of Kings of the Road and you carve up the royalties with Toby Hagen, what do you go out and buy?
Me?
Yeah. Dream car?
There's about 20 on the list, but I think
one.
The motoring journo's default response is a Porsche 911, so that's what it
Which
would be.
Which one?
I would actually get a Carrera base model 7-speed manual, just because
what,
it's
modern one.
Yeah.
What about a sort of thin bumper Targa?
No. I've grown up with the modern ones. They're the ones I enjoy.
Oh, okay.
Sorry,
Paul.
Too many to name, John. I depends
one,
what occasion.
On.
Mini Cooper S.
Oh, early one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not the modern one.
Oh no, no.
Proper early 60s rally Italian 1275
motor.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. No heater.
No heater.
No.
No radio.
No.
Sorry, John.
Oh, it doesn't trouble me. You want to listen to the engine. That's the whole point. No point asking you, Harriet. You don't
know. No point asking me at all.
No. Well, maybe as an object of beauty. What would you put on a plinth in your living room?
Oh, the E-Type.
E-Type. Mm. Early flat floor convertible.
Mm. Well, I don't know the...
Yeah. Or various... a coupe. With a roof or without?
With a roof, I think.
Excellent. Harriet Edquist, who teaches design at RMIT and is president of the Automotive Historians Australia. Paul Berenger, his book Crayon to Cat is available from C2C Publishing. And Bruce Newton's book King of the Road, 50 Cars That Drove Australia. It's been great fun. Thank you all for coming. This has been The Conversation Hour on your ABC.